Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome to the official Tennis.com podcast, featuring professional coach and community leader, Kamal Murray.
Welcome to the Tennis.com podcast. I am your host, Kamal Murray. And let's talk about what we just saw at Indian Wells. I'm going to make it brief. Jack Sock is the best doubles player in the world, regardless of who he plays with, regardless of the surface. Carlos Alcaraz is up next. The way he plays, his style, limits his ability to have bad days. He needs to develop a weapon, but for now, he's coming up. Jensen Brooksby proves that toughness, heart, and effort will be talent and strokes any day. And Taylor Fritz owes Riley Opelka and Nick Kyrgios a hug. Those two players pushed Nadal to the brink, kept him on the court a long time, and wore him down leading into the final. If you look at all the matches Nadal has played in this tournament, players are catching up. They're getting closer and closer and closer, especially on the hard court. Time is catching up with them. And on the women's side, Iga Swiatek is probably the best woman on tour today. She beat some very good players in the way that we don't see that often. Not many people give Maddie Keys a 6-0 set, as well as she serves. The dominance, the heart, the girl can play, and she deserved to win that week. This week on the show, we have Stephen Arbitrage. Stephen is an executive at UTR, former USTA coach, coached numerous pros on tour, played college tennis at Duke, and is the husband of Allison Risk. We get into a lot of talk today about the mystery behind UTR, the algorithm, what it means to tennis, how it's changing tennis, what we need to do to keep moving the game forward. And we talk about life as a tennis husband, hiring coaches, working on the road. Take a listen and enjoy. Welcome to the Tennis.com podcast. I'm your host, Kamal Murray, and we got my brother here who we traveled to 3-4 different continents, 20 different countries, spent 30 weeks together on the road. One of the guys I used to see in the bar, now I don't. I see him in the lobby with his laptop all the time. He's a big wig over at UTR now, which is sort of reshaping the way tennis is thought of and played at every level. You know, and me, his name is Stephen Arbitrage. Let's welcome him to the show.
Thanks, Kamal. I appreciate that. That is quite the intro. I have been spending significantly more time on my laptop these days. So yes, that's correct.
I used to see you on the court, maybe dropping an F-bomb here and there. Now I see you sitting in some corner looking for some Wi-Fi, trying to have a Zoom call with somebody that's 3 a.m. on the U.S. state. So tell us about your ascent into tennis and sort of how you got to where you are now. Because I'd look at sort of, you know, my journey in tennis, and I'm probably somewhere I shouldn't be, never thought I would be, you know, dibbling, dabbling in different realms, but you're doing it on a whole nother level.
Well, I mean, I appreciate that. I think we all have our own journey, and, you know, there's steps along the way where each of us has gotten to where we've gotten. I played juniors. I went to Duke for college tennis. I played a little bit of doubles on the tour. I had some knee injuries pretty early. And then I kind of went into coaching really early, like, you know, as soon as I was done. Rajiv Ram, who's my best friend and my cousin Prakash, when they're kind of challenger level players, said, hey, look, I think you'd always be good at this. Do you want to try it out for a little bit? And, you know, it was a little sad. Like, I still had a competitive fire, but I just was not healthy enough to kind of like keep going myself. So like, that was kind of a little bit of a sad point for me, where I was like, okay, well, maybe I would be okay at this. And so I started coaching them. Rajiv won Newport, the ATP title, within 6 months. So we were kind of moving in the right direction, but, you know, it was really starting from kind of that bottom, you know, I mean, as a coach and as someone who is working with challenger level players, not even top 100 players at the time until you earn it. I got burned out a little bit, and then, you know, ended up kind of doing a stint with Fish, with Marty, coaching him, or really kind of being an assistant coach to kind of the program that they had. He was top 10 at the time, and I just learned so much from him. So, you know, that was kind of like my initiation into kind of like top level tennis. I then kind of worked for the USTA as a national coach, mostly for the men's program in Carson, and then kind of oversaw the collegiate program for the USTA before joining on as an executive at Universal Tennis, formerly UTR. The one thing I'm really proud of is, like, I don't feel like I skipped any steps. Like, started from the bottom, started at $600 a week, you know, coaching these guys, and, you know, kind of like grinding it out, like, from, like, really, really, truly the bottom. And, like, it was everything that I needed to learn and observe. It was like a doctorate in tennis. So I'm really proud of, like, my journey with that, because there was no shortcuts taken.
But your bottom is different than most people's bottom, because you're have some tennis lineage, right? BJ Armitage is a relative of yours. So,
correct.
Like, mine was the bottom. Mine is like 72nd and Jeffrey, you know, tennis racket from Walmart, trying to hide my tennis racket in the garbage can behind my house so my friends didn't see me walking to and from bus. Yours was like, my brother's BJ Armitage. So you got, like, it's in your blood.
Look, I hear you. And, like, I have been incredibly lucky at, you know, the kind of starting point that my family put me in. But, you know, I mean, I do believe that there's an element of earning the process yourself. So, yeah, it's different for everyone. And kind of for my professionalism and for my kind of starting point as a coach, and then kind of, you know, working into an administrator and executive, you know, I'm proud to say that, like, my journey has been what I feel, you know, I'm something that I'm really proud of. And, you know, it's not been something where I believe that, you know, kind of a starting point has got me there, but it's something that I've tried to learn and earn myself.
Now, your cousin Prakash is famous for his muscles.
And he is.
And I always see him working out, but you are kind of like me. Like, my version of workout is working out my fingers on my laptop. I don't see you in the gym. How did you all get on totally different paths like that?
Well, look, I think it's, the two things that Prakash and I have in common is just an, you know, I mean, a very strong competitive drive. My competitive drive is really around kind of where I feel like I can add value to, you know, the business end of the sport, to the company that I've, you know, committed my career to my wife, who I feel like, Allison, who I feel like, you know, I want to try to be helpful to and kind of there for whenever we need. And then kind of last, after all that, like, if there's some time left in the day and some energy left, like, you know, we'll do certain, you know, kind of stuff that, you know, is physical or kind of on myself. But I look at this as, I'm a giving guy. I feel like I'm a pretty selfless guy. And the energy that I have is usually dedicated to that. I mean, Prakash has a brand that is, you know, very visible. And I think it's pretty incredible, actually, because the one thing about him, and the one thing that I wake up kind of inspired by each day, is his dedication and his discipline and his commitment. Obviously, I think everyone is going to have that in different degrees and kind of different, you know, just paths for that. And so I know, and it's very easy to see, and it's very easy to get a motivating text message from him each day. Like, you know, I mean, I know that he's going for it. And, you know, for someone as close to me as that, it makes me want to do the same.
So you mentioned Allison. So you're the husband of Allison Risk. And I always talk to John Lloyd and give him shit all the time, because I say, I mean, the dude was a professional tennis player, British legend, and he was known as Chris Evert's husband, right? Or Chris Evert's ex-husband. How do you deal with that?
Well, I mean, look, like, I think that I'm incredibly proud of Allie. I mean, and there's definitely going to be some people who think of me as her husband. I think of myself as my own person. And, you know, I think that I've achieved enough kind of in this right now, in the sport and in the ecosystem that we live in, to, you know, be known as Stephen Armitage and kind of proud of what I've done. You know, for her, I'm her biggest fan, and I always will be. And, you know, I want to see her do great and to the best of her ability each day. And, you know, if there's a situation where I need to kind of be helpful or put her in front of me or do whatever I can to you know, making her be in the best position to succeed, you know, I'm definitely going to try to be helpful there.
So I primarily coach women, right? Me just I actually prefer, you know, I feel like girls process stuff like quicker. You got to say it a little more sensitively, right? And sometimes you got to take the back door where guys, you like be like a little more direct, you go right at them. So you've obviously coached a lot of men at the collegiate level, as well as on tour. You've coached one woman that I know. Tell me the difference between coaching men and women.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think that is right. It seems to be, you know, way more of a, I think in general, you can be a little bit more straightforward with the guys. But quite honestly, like I think that regardless of the gender of the player, they want the truth. And they want the honesty that, you know, someone is going to give them in terms of how they're going to be the best player that they can be. And so they're all competitors. They're in the top 0.0001% of what they do in the world. And you're just talking about, I mean, just razor thin margins on whether you're going to be winning or losing and whether you're going to be top 10, top 20, you know, top 50, top 100. And, you know, I think the interesting thing on that canal is like, you know, they're earning their job every week and they're kind of on the firing line each week, you know? So whether they're trying to make a cut for a bigger event or whether they're trying to make, you know, top 100 to be able to kind of make the grand slams or whether they're able to be 9 versus 8 and making, you know, the world tour finals, like those are big, big, big kind of like margins that are just kind of like right there that can basically make a career and, you know, kind of not make a career. And so they want the truth. They want things said to them. I mean, that's going to make them better. At least I've found the people that I've worked with to be very coachable. And, you know, I try to give that to them. I think that the key as a coach is trying to find out the best way to say the same things, you know, over and over again, depending on who you're talking to.
Yeah, the difference I found is when to say it, right? I think they all want the truth. It's just picking your spots on when is the right time to either address it, you know, whether it's immediately after the match, 30 minutes after, or even over dinner, or even the next day, right? When they're willing to receive it. And I think when I look at, like, from my coaching career, coaching multiple players, when we weren't successful, I didn't poke the bear. And what I would say to like a young coach is always poke the bear, right? Because at a certain level, you figure, you feel like, okay, this player's 3 in the world. They're probably a better tennis player than I ever was.
Sure.
Doesn't look as sharp right now, but in the next hour and a half, they'll work it out, right? Sure. But when they get on the court, it'll work itself out. And then you find, like, it doesn't, right? Or it didn't. Or, damn, I wish I would have said that. Do you find that to sort of be the case as well?
I mean, look, I think for young coaches out there, you need to find your voice. You need to earn your trust before you say anything. But look, for me, and this is what I believe, like whether it's, you know, working with players or working with, you know, people in our company, whatever it is, like, I don't want to leave anything unsaid. And the fact that if we feel like as a group and as, you know, something that I believe in strongly, that it's going to make people better. And I think that that's the key point. I mean, whether that's poking the bear or not, like, I think we're all here to try to improve, myself included. And I'm willing to take advice from anyone to do that. And I think that the people that I want to surround myself with are willing to be open-minded enough for that and have a growth mindset with it. So, you know, I wouldn't leave anything unsaid, especially if you feel like it's going to leave someone better than what you found them. So, yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree with that anymore.
So you left the USTA.
Yep.
Went to work for Universal Tennis.
Yep.
And at the time it was new. And I would say when UTR, you know, formerly UTR, now Universal Tennis, came out, what excited me about it was this. When you look at sort of the ranking system and the point system, right? I remember I was coaching like, you know, 3 or 4 girls, all of them were top 50 in the country, right? None of them had won a tournament in over 2 years. But they were able to play a lot of tournaments, quarters of a lot, round of 16 of a lot, and be top 50 in the country, right? Because you could basically accumulate and buy a lot of points, right? If you can afford to travel, boom, your ranking is gonna like incrementally go up. And in the space that I work in, working with minority players or people who are late starters to the game or sure. don't have the money to travel, what excited me about UTR was that I could get judged on the quality of the matches, right? If somebody happens to fly to Chicago and play a tournament, I could basically eat off their ranking, right? Or their rating without having to spend money to go fly to Easter Bowl or whatever it is like that. And so I don't know if that was the impetus behind it, but it did sort of level the playing field versus quality over quantity. I do think UTR is still a mystery to some people. They're still trying to figure out the algorithm, how to manipulate it. Can you give us like back of the envelope crash course on UTR?
Sure. Well, look, I mean, first of all, I'm really happy that you've had that experience with it, because that is what it's intended to do. You know, it's intended to basically give everyone an indication of their level by the competitiveness of how they play against who they play, right? Rankings are flawed for a variety of reasons. They have people, their places are geographically kind of more in line with having more points. So by example, if you take it to the ATP level, like there's something like 60 to 70% of the tournaments that are on the ATP tour, especially in the pathway, are in Europe. So like you have also corresponding 60% of the professionals who are in the top 100 from Europe. Right. You may have areas like Minnesota that do not have very many, you know, tournaments that players from there are going to suffer because of a lack of ranking points as opposed to a Florida or a Southern California. So I think what UTR does and the rating that I love and that I believe in wholeheartedly is, you know, really a few things. Number one, like those people who are looking at it to try to manipulate it, like, I hear you. That was the first thing that I did as, you know, kind of director of college tennis at the USTA. I basically went to all these colleges and had them privately finance, you know, futures and challengers because we needed more points on American soil versus Europe. And with that, we were able to get so many more collegiate players through. So like, believe me, I'm the first person who looks at it and is like, okay, like how can we structure this to the situation where, you know, where we give our players advantages? The issue is with UTR is that you can't really game it. It's just so incredibly good in terms of who you play, what the score was. And, you know, when you look at it from a zoomed out perspective, you're able to have every match that you play count for your rating. It's not going to matter whether you play an ITF tournament or, you know, a future or a juniors or, you know, kind of a sectional tournament or, you know, a national level L2, you know, and you have all these points, but the point from the L2 doesn't go into juniors and junior ITFs don't go into pro ITF. Like the fragmented nature of tennis is an absolute, is just chaos, really, quite honestly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the thing that I've always felt with UTR, the rating that's really awesome is every time you step on the court, whether it's for a high school match, whether it's for a UTR match play, whether it's for, you know, a USTA L2 or sectional tournament or ITF, whatever, that's all aggregated together to give you the best level, the best indication of your level. So for me, like I'm just a huge proponent of that, not only because you're able to have every match count, but you're also able to see where you are kind of across this continuum of tennis. And so my, just as a last item, because it's relevant to the Universal Tennis Hurt Awards, which gives $100,000 to college players coming out of school. The first time that I really saw this was when I was working in Carson with the USTA, and Mackie McDonald used to come down from UCLA and hit with Stevie Johnson and Sam Querrey, who were both top 50 at the time, and Austin Krychek, who I was working with, who was about like 120. And like, we were able to see that Mackie was pretty close to a top 100 level player. And, you know, just on his college results, he's number one in college, but he's 900 on the tour. Like, where does this guy fit? And that's where I really got to know UTR was, hey, UTR had him at the time at about 100 in the world, which is exactly where I thought he was. And I was like, wow, this is really interesting. So, you know, it just gives an objective understanding of the player's level in a fairly murky world of understanding kind of, you know, where you are with rankings that can be manipulated.
So, you know, the algorithm is very complex, yep. Right? Which it has to be complex to work. And one of the things that I learned early on is that, you know, in junior parents, they always want their kids to play up, right?
Sure.
And as a coach, you know, even at this level, we talk about like the small, minute difference between being 25 in the world and six in the world, literally, yeah. Right? You know, I coached a player and was probably one bad line call on the left sideline away from number one on clay, right? Yeah. And so what I always tell parents is play your level, right? Play people who are your level so you actually learn how to win.
Yep.
Playing up against somebody and getting your brains beat in doesn't necessarily benefit you, because I think people inherently know how to fight.
Yep.
Right? But playing somebody that's like, you know, close to your level and learn how to think and win close matches is a longer, it's a better benefit long-term to your development. So now, if you play somebody that's 2 points higher or lower than you in your UTR rating, the match doesn't count. What's the logic behind that?
Yeah, I mean, look, first of all, so there's two parts of that that I want to comment on. So starting with the 2.0, you know, kind of, I don't want to call it a rule, but like some kind of the 2.0 situation, you know, we have so much data in our system that shows that when a result, you know, there's so little chance of a win or even kind of a competitive match at that level. And we define competitive match as somewhere about a closer match than 6-4, 6-4. We have so little results that make sense on that, you know, we actually don't count anything over a 2.0 level. However, if someone within that time gets to be within a 2.0 level of the person that they played, we store the result, and that result is actually able to come on, whether positive or detrimental to the player. So like, we have it. We just are saying we have better indications of your level than if, by example, and you're in women's tennis, like a 2.0 difference would be the player who's 350 in the world playing Ash Barty, who's number one. Mm-hmm. So like the 2.0 difference would be someone who's number one in college playing Novak Djokovic. So
let me ask you this question.
Yeah.
So what you're saying is if I played somebody, if a kid played somebody that's 2.0 higher than them,
yep.
Okay, that match is still stored in your data. Once sure. The kid that lost, obviously, to the player, or the lower kid
yep.
comes within a point,
yep.
then that match will now fall into their sort of database?
Yes, within their last 30.
Okay, got it.
Within their last 30. I mean, even if it's 1.9 or 1.99, you know, that will come onto the system. Now,
when does that expire, though? Is it like a two-year time limit? Is it 1 year?
If it's within their last 30 matches, as got the entire UTR algorithm takes only your last 30 matches over a 15-month period, right? However, what I would say is that in that match, if he or she loses badly, that also counts.
Right.
So, like, that's the kind of, like, it's not a one-way street when you're playing people higher than you. And, like, there is this intention of like, oh, we should play someone higher than that. That's not true. Actually, the fastest way to improve your UTR is actually the hardest way to improve your UTR, which is, you alluded to it. You want to play players at your level and you want to beat them pretty decisively to the point where you're proving you're actually not at that level
mm-hmm.
consistently over and over again.
Right.
So we've seen people make pretty big runs in the highest levels of UTR when they're basically going through, you know, multiple tournaments and winning straight set match after straight set match after straight set match, probably at their level, you know, not so much that they're beating, you know, whatever, Daniil Medvedev 3-3-3, that
right.
is not going to happen.
Because right? he's so tanked, right?
I think that's kind of one of the misconceptions. The only other thing I'd say to parents is exactly what you mentioned, like try to just zoom out a little bit and understand that the rating is best used when you're not looking at every 0.01 up and one down. You're looking at it over a 2-3 month period. You're seeing that there's improvement. It's gradual over time because it's never that fast. And the fact that if you work and you compete and you continue to focus on becoming a better player, your rating will correlate to that.
Well, I equate it to this, right? So, you know, I look at like pro tennis, and number one, they take your best 16 results, right? And your ranking is primarily comprised about that. That's number one. Number two, time on court, right? So if you are 25 in the world and you are on the court with somebody that qualified and they're 170 in the world and you're 7-5 in the third, there should be a negative impact to your UTR based on you not winning 2-2 like you should have. Because in real life, there's negative impact to your body. If that's a first round match and you're 7-5 in the third with somebody 170 in the world, you're on the court probably an hour and a half longer, which is going to hurt you for the next round. The hour and a half longer on court also puts you at risk for getting injured in that time frame. which could have a longer impact, right? A more negative impact on your career long term. And so beating people you're supposed to beat and the manner you're supposed to beat them is a skill that should be encouraged, rewarded, and or penalized, right? At a younger age, because let's say you do make it in college. Let's say you do make it on tour. The impact of not beating somebody you're supposed to beat, how you're supposed to beat them, could have career-ending injuries, right? So I look at like someone like Francis Tiafoe, who I love to death. He's somebody I would say that every now and then might have a mental lapse and ends up on court an extra set than he should be, right? And the impact of that, thank God, has not been, but could be dangerous from that extra hour and a half on court.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think I can speak at it from the UTR and the rating level, like, and just kind of the what would happen there. And like in the example you used, like, you know, if you're close with someone who's 170 and they're actually the 170th best player in the world, you know, the indication, just again zooming out and taking a step back, is like, look, like, you're probably not playing up to your standard as whatever the 10th best player in the world or whatever you wanted to use in that example, right? Like, if you're playing close with the number 170, there's usually probably one of two things that are happening. Number one, the person who's 170 is probably way better than 170 because they're right. Or two, your level is on the day probably not as good as number 10 in the world or whatever it may be, right? And I think that concept is what UTR tries to put a kind of gauge on. And you will get an understanding of your level, probably best in the world, because we're able to unify all the, you know, kind of results and systems that are out there on one standard. But that is kind of like the concept of it. And yeah, it makes you perform to the best of your ability each day, which, you know, kind of as a challenge and as a competitor, I think is something that a lot of people should want to do.
But it also speaks to the other thing that UTR measures, which is the trend, right? So that person that's 170 could be playing better 100%. Over the last 90 days. And the person that's 20, 25, who's got, 12, 52 weeks of points that haven't fallen off,
yep,
could be playing worse, right? And so, like, the trend, right, also
could be awesome. I couldn't agree anymore. I mean, in general, I would say when I look at the ratings, especially at the professional level, and you can tell me what your thoughts are, but I feel like we're usually about 4 to 5 months ahead of the rankings in both spaces. And like, it's been more evident lately because like the rankings have been skewed over what tournaments played or what tournaments didn't, and kind of longer than a 12-month period. But like, there have been multiple examples, like where Jenny Brady was trending in our top 10 before she, you know, kind of made semis of the US Open and finals of the AO. I mean, we've had Danielle Collins really close to top 10 for the last 4 months. She just made finals of the AO and kind of got there. You know, another one is Carlos Alcaraz. I think we have like 5 or 6 right now currently. And like, obviously he's a little bit behind that, but you're seeing his level and you're like, wow, like the guy's pretty special, you know? So I think that's where those things is kind of like where, I mean, another one's Jensen Brooksby. You know, we've had him at pretty close to like 15 for a little bit, probably like 2-3 months. He's not there yet, but I think that there's a belief that his level is going to get him there. And, you know, if his wins over Tsitsipas this week and kind of like where we feel like, hey, this is a tight match against Norrie, who's 11 in the world, like, you know, I think that over time, those results will play out with the indication of level that, you know, UTR gives people.
So we run a lot of junior tournaments at our academy, probably 38 to 40.
Nice. I like it.
Oh, man. What we see a lot is people will lose in the front draw.
Sure.
Right? Pull out of the back draw in an attempt to maybe avoid a bad loss. I call it match ducking, right? Duck a match or whatever like that.
Mm-hmm.
What is UTR doing anything? And ultimately, from a coaching standpoint, I'm looking at, look, a 14-year-old, they need a lot of matches, right? Sure. I look at like, you know, being a good student is you show up in group, you got a great coach, you take private lessons, all other kind of stuff. And then matches to me is like test prep, taking the ACT, right? The Kaplan courses. And so when I see people duck matches, I'm like, no, dude, you're 15. What you need is more matches, right? Because that's the job, is to learn how to like compete and win a match. So is UTR doing anything to try to discourage or punish ducking matches?
Yeah. So, I mean, great question. First of all, it's probably about a 2%. So two out of every 100 matches from the data that we've gotten shows that there is a default in some way. Now, you know, they're actually crazily split 50-50 between main draw and back draw. And they're split 50-50 between higher rated UTR and lower rated UTR. So it's kind of nuts because, like, we hear a lot of anecdotal stuff about people pulling out of the back draw. And, like, there'd be a lot with that. There could be the fact that people just don't want to play in the back draw. There could be the fact that people don't want to hang around anymore. There's all kinds of those things. What we do is we actually flag the number of withdrawals at the top of someone's results. So, like, it will show, hey, look, this pro player has whatever, like, one withdrawal in their last, you know, 30 matches or whatever it is, or they're above two or three, I would start being like, wow, that's probably something that's, you know, a little bit of a habit. But, you know, as a coach, and Kamau, I throw it back to you a little bit. Like, I mean, like, I think that we need to kind of help educate coaches and help educate parents that, like, look, like, matches are what's needed, especially at 14 years old. You need to go out there and try to learn how to compete and learn how to win. And, you know, I mean, I would also question the, you know, the culture from the coach and kind of, you know, the support team around each of these players. That's going to be like, yeah, you know, it's a good idea. Like, don't do that.
That player is not going to make it because.
Yeah. So, like, I mean, it's kind of, I think that is really the question that we should be having. Like, why are players being allowed to do that? If they are, you know, and I think that we have an understanding that the number is probably not as high as people think it is, but it's just so glaring. And I think it kind of is irritating to, you know, people who are in coaching or people who, you know, work hard to put on tournaments when that does happen. And, you know, I would just really kind of, you know, ask the coaches and parents, like, look, like, is that what you want to really teach your kids? Because those lessons there are going to be kind of kept and stay with you. And I think one of the best and most challenging things about tennis is the ability to go out there and earn it every day. And if, like, you're playing someone who is not of your level, showing up, doing your job, taking care of business, that's a skill that's going to, you know, translate and be with you for the rest of your life, whether you're playing tennis or whether you're obviously going to, you know, move on to other things.
Yeah. So when I think about, like, coaching at tour level, like, I think that, you know, players don't change, right? They become more of themselves. And when I look at juniors, right, and I look at sort of like, if you look at the American juniors that are world-ranked, winning junior slams, it's lower than the rest of the world, right? And I think at this level, there's an element of toughness that is missing or is not being taught. And so when I see a player duck a match or not be encouraged to play the match, A, I would never coach that player. Because even if you can hit the shot out the ball and you can move, if you ain't tough, you ain't gonna make it. Right. And that and when we have juniors, that's what we're shaping them, right? That's what we're teaching them. When they get 25 and you've allowed them to duck matches and be soft and pull out and all this other kind of cheat and that kind of stuff, you're not gonna reshape them at 25, right? They're just gonna, like, blow up into this real tennis monster that you allowed them to become at 14. And so I think it's hurting the toughness of our sport. And I'm sure you would agree, when you start competing globally or you have aspirations to compete globally, everybody can hit the ball, everybody can move, can you fight, right? And can you do it at five all dudes? And I see that this behavior is going to say, no, they can't do it, right? And I wouldn't want them on my team in college.
Yeah, right? I mean, look, like, and that's it. And, like, that's why we flag it, because college coaches have said to us, we want to know kind of, like, what the character of these players are before we start recruiting. And, you know, I mean, they're very grateful for having this kind of information. Look, Kamau, like, I'd agree with you, man. Like, you know, in general, like, tennis is such an incredible metaphor for life. And I think that's where people who have played the sport really kind of value, when they look back on it, what they learned in juniors. Like, yeah, the ability to kind of go out there and be tough and, like, learn toughness and learn how to fight and learn how to problem solve and learn how to do those things is really kind of what it's all about at that level. I mean, you and I both can probably chuckle looking at the 14-year-old right now. Like, this is an incredibly long journey. They're probably, I mean, if they're going to get really good at tennis, they're probably not even halfway through kind of where they would want to be with their tennis life at 14 years old, you know? So, like, take a step back, focus on improvement, focus on getting better each day. Know that this is an incredibly long process, and try to make the right decisions for the overall improvement of your game. I mean, that would be the kind of mantra that I would give to players that are of a young age and kind of really focused. I mean, I was too, really focused on like the next day, the next result, the next kind of like tournament that they're playing. Just try to take a step back, look at the big picture, improve every day, enjoy the process, and really have fun with what you're doing.
So you mentioned that college coaches will come to you all, give you feedback. I think one of the things that tennis in general struggles with is we're not a nimble sport, mm-hmm. right? We got Grand Slam Committee, WTA, ATP, you know, NCAA, ITA, ITF, Fed Cup, all this other kind of thing, right? But UTR, Universal Tennis, has seemed to be almost like a tennis tech startup, right? Where you can open to new ideas and are very nimble. An example of that is what you guys did during the pandemic. Tell me sort of like what you all are doing to move forward, right? I just heard that there was an Amazon deal. Like, you know, you guys are always have new, like sort of that's going coming up. Tell me like what y'all moving. I know you, your fingers be tapping away. I'm like, yeah, bro, you know, Allie's practicing over there. And you like, yeah, I'm on his own. You know what I mean? Like those fingers are tapping away. Tell me where you're moving next.
Well, I mean, look, I think you hit the nail on the head, and I appreciate the compliment on us being nimble. We have an incredibly hardworking team. And yeah, we are a tennis technology company. We're not, you know, we're not necessarily married to tradition. We feel like, you know, tradition absolutely has a incredible place in the sport, but, you know, we're going to try to improve it however we can. So a lot of the products that we've come out with have attempted to do just that. So whether they're new, the rating itself to start out to aggregate everyone in the world on the best indication of their level, whether it's the ability like you to run tournaments and give people a local affordable option at more match play through events at, you know, at their facility. You know, we've decentralized the ability to do that and allowed kind of more people to play. We've put together these amazing things called Flex Leagues, where basically you have, you know, a three match aggregation of almost like a decentralized ability for you and me, if we're the same level, to play over a 4-week period with people in your area. So now we're, I think we're in about like 70 markets globally on that. And it just offers incredible flexibility in terms of people playing tennis. So, you know, I mean, think of it like instead of having to play a Saturday and Sunday tournament, you're able to schedule a match at a time and place that you guys both agree on, you know, and I think that this is more for the recreational adult market, but can be used for really anyone. And then I think you know as well, but we've come out with a 25K tour that has had 185 tournaments in 15 countries last year and led to this, you know, awesome partnership with Amazon. All those matches starting in kind of middle of this year, you know, quarter two and beyond is going to be on Amazon Prime, which is something that we're really excited about. I mean, you know, the ability to kind of work with the company that is probably the biggest company in the world and, you know, bring them into tennis and have them kind of believe in what we're doing is just an incredible validation for our team. So, you know, I appreciate what you said about the pandemic. We worked hard. I think that the entire sport had to pivot. And, you know, from our end, like, this is just the beginning. We're going to continue to look for solutions like a technology company should, you know, in tennis and, you know, really try to kind of continue to make people's experiences and just overall life better when they play the sport and more enjoyable.
Yeah. So, you know, we held tournaments in Chicago this summer and the hospitality portion of it definitely presents a challenge. You got to, you know, guarantee them 5 nights. You got to transport them to and from. You got to feed them on site, player plus two, player, all that other kind of stuff. So, you know, I do see that. Tell me about like the difference between, let's say, WTA model, right? USTA 80K challenger model versus the UTR pro tournament model. And yeah. what it would allow a smaller organization to run an event without all the sort of mandatory hospitality, et cetera.
Yeah, sure. I mean, look, that's what we did. You know, we kind of took a look at kind of the standards for, you know, the levels of 25K tournaments that are out there, met the ones that we feel like were critical, i.e. referee levels and, you know, having, you know, basic standards around kind of just stuff for the players, player lounge and balls and practice courts and, you know, lights and all those things. But we stripped down the other options that like really cause stress on both an organizer and a player. What we did was we created a format where there's a round robin. So you're going to have guaranteed matches per week, you know, in the WTA or ATP or ITF, like pretty much any level of tennis. Like, you can go and get a bad draw first round and get knocked out and lose 7-6 in a third, and then have this cost incurred to you where you're paying for a hotel room each night before you're able to get to the next week. So, you know, in our system, we have 3 round robin matches where if you kind of win your group or kind of come in second or wherever you place, like, you then go into the quarterfinals and beyond based on whoever else won their group. So look, that guaranteed matches has the ability, as you mentioned, for players that are developing to continue to develop by getting more competitive opportunities. And we've seen incredible feedback. I think we're, you know, something like 95% plus of players that have played in our tournaments play again. And they also say like how much they enjoy that kind of format. So basically you're able to get more matches in 1 week. You're able to do it in a place, like, we like to try to have 2 in a row in the same city. That way, thinking, you know, and invoking new technology, hey, look, you're going to go to a place, you're going to try to get an Airbnb for 14 days. You're not going to incur kind of, you know, a daily rate on a hotel. You're able to kind of do this in bulk. You're able to hopefully have many matches. You're able to, you know, go there and get what we feel like is pretty good money. It's the best money kind of at that level from a 25K perspective. And, you know, you're able to do that. You're able to compete, get better, and then, you know, kind of continue to improve. So, I mean, this has all been done with kind of a technological focus. The other thing is that every single one of these matches are streamed. And so they're either on, they were on YouTube, but now they're going to move to Amazon Prime. So that's something where, I mean, you know how it is. If you're a developing player, you're trying to bring a coach with you, but if you're making, you know, $200 a week, that's impossible, you know, financially. So now here you have the ability to have your coach like watch you on stream, give you thoughts, give you advice, give you kind of concepts, have you yourself as a player learn without incurring a cost that, you know, is obviously going to be a fee per week, hotel and expenses and all these other things that make the sport really difficult financially for players of that level. So, you know, out of all the things that I've done, like this and working with our team to try to create this has been one of the things that I'm most proud of because I think that it's really going to be able to help a lot of people in their development and in their journey to try to achieve their dreams of being a professional tennis player.
The other thing that I think, you know, last year we looked at doing it, and I think having it on Amazon Prime answers the question that a tour or a tournament organizer would need to a sponsor to say, where's it going to be televised? Sure. Or streamed? How many people are going to watch it? How many people are going to see my logo? And so I think being able to answer that question is a step forward for that model as well. Because there are still costs, right? Fucking balls and cleanup and security. And
no, I mean, look, you're right. I think that, you know, we're elevating the standard of 25K tournaments by having every single one of them on Amazon Prime, like full stop, you know? And the fact that we're able to do that and, you know, have it be kind of in partnership with, as I mentioned, you know, one of the biggest streaming platforms in the world is something that we're incredibly excited about. And I think that the sport should be, you know, really fired up about.
So I got 2 more questions. You've been on here a long time. How did you choose Duke? I know, you know, like Tommy Paul always tells the joke about how he wanted to go to North Carolina, but they wouldn't give him a full scholarship. Right. And so, how did you choose Duke and what would have been your second choice?
Well, it's really funny. I mean, my mom, who means a lot to me and passed away about a year ago this time, wanted me to get a great education out of going to, you know, wherever I was going to choose for college. So I was kind of very academically focused and, you know, I was a pretty good tennis player. I'd say that I was probably top 10 in my recruiting class. I wouldn't say that I was the best, but I definitely was, you know, had the interest of some schools. I set foot on the campus at Duke. I love the coach. I love the guys on the team. And, you know, it's just really been a place that's, you know, near and dear to my heart. I was also looking at some of the other top academic places like Stanford and Harvard. Those are kind of my 3 that I was choosing between. But, you know, I thought that Duke was just a place that was special to my heart. And I really believe in going with your gut in a lot of things. And that was one of them that I definitely did. And I'm really happy that I did.
So my last question is, the other side of you, I look at you like a tennis parent because you're a former coach. You know a lot about the game at multiple levels and your wife's a pro tennis player, but you can't coach her yourself. So for me, I'm thinking like that would be a nightmare of a job, right? To have to coach this dude's wife and he used to be a coach on tour, coach USGA, et cetera, et cetera. Name the top 5 coaches you know on tour right now. And they can even be men's coaches. They don't even have to be girls' coaches. And I knew I was going to fuck you up with that one. So top 5 coaches on tour right now, 1. And 2, Do you choose when Allie's evaluating a coach, do you weigh in or do you stay out of it?
Well, I mean, look, those are two interesting questions. And yeah, I mean, look, every tennis parent who's listening to this, like, I feel you. Like, I know what you're going through. I can feel the emotions. I can feel all of that because I deal with it on a pretty weekly basis. I try to give Allie input on her coaches. I think that she's been around for, 13, 14, 15 years. So she kind of knows what she wants. And over the course of her career and over the course, if you're a tennis parent listening to this, over the course of your child's career, you're probably going to need different things at different times. So I think that she's been aware of her own game enough to know kind of like what she needs. And I think that she's been really lucky. She's only had a few coaches, and I feel like they've each been there for the right time that they've had it. Look, I can't comment on who's the best coach or who I feel like is a great coach. I feel like a lot of people are doing a pretty phenomenal job. But like, with that being said, like, I know who I've learned from, and like, they've been from, people of all kind of all kind of ages, of all kind of backgrounds. And, a lot of that has been through my time at the USTA. I do think, like, just off the top of my head, like Jose Aguirre, Kathy Rinaldi, Brad Stein, Jay Berger, Paul Anacone. I've had amazingly productive and insightful conversations with Lindsay Davenport. And then I feel like each one of Allie's coaches who I've been lucky enough to kind of get a kind of more of a under the hood look from, I've really learned a lot from. And like, I think that is the key thing as a tennis parent. So whether it's Tom Gutteridge, who's Allie's current coach, or Billy Heiser or Yves Boulay, who are two of her former coaches, if you're there trying to really insert yourself in the situation, your player, your child, your wife in this case, is only going to know kind of like what you know. And like, I want her to figure out everything that like I don't know. I'm there to kind of give advice to the coach when coach asks me and when they want my advice. And besides that, I'm just trying to, hopefully be as positive as I can for everyone in the situation, and make sure that kind of, that everything that I can be helpful with is taken care of. And like, as a tennis parent, or as me, like in this case, I think that's just reinforcing what the coach is saying to the player and kind of trying to not send mixed messages by your actions or by your words when you're not at home, when you're not on court with the player. So, if the coach is saying, hey, look, like, you got to work hard and you got to really kind of dedicate yourself to the sport off the court. And then, we're not doing that off the court. And obviously that's not any time that you, the coach, or whoever you're working with is going to be with the player. Like, you need to kind of keep that continuation of the
process. Be on board. Like, because I look at, like, I always tell parents, yo, you're about to drive an hour home, don't undo what I did.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean? Like, don't, because you spend an hour or 2 hours with the player, they go home, they got a long ass car ride, don't undo what I just did, right?
I think, truly, I understand where they're coming from, because this is a costly sport. This is a costly sport financially. This is a costly sport time-wise. This is a costly sport emotionally. You want your child to do so well, your wife to do so well. But there is a time and a place where you need to be the parent, the husband, and not kind of get involved. And I think that, the more that I learn, the less I try to be involved, because, it's something that I would never want my role to be anything different than family.
Yeah. Well, brother, I appreciate you taking so much time with us. This was a really interesting discussion on so many levels.
Very enjoyable.
When I see you after a match, I give you that look, you give me that look, and I know exactly what you're thinking, and you know exactly how I'm feeling, right? And you have the luxury of being at the laptop and not having to give the post-match speech. So, So it's all good, man. I want to thank you. I want to wish you a lot of success and, keep moving the game forward. And I appreciate your time.
You as well. Thanks for the opportunity to come on, and appreciate you letting me talk with you about all this stuff.
All right, guys, this has been a tennis.com podcast with Stephen Armitage, executive at Universal Tennis. And I got to give you my John Lloyd Chris Everything. and husband of Allison Riss.
I'll take that as a second. Appreciate that.
Thank you, brother.
All right, man. Talk to you soon.
All right, thank you, son.
Peace.